Hello and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast where Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts discuss international issues of the day. My name is Jonathan Pryke, and I direct the Pacific Islands program here at the Lowy Institute. I'm thrilled to be talking today, from one lockdown to another, with Deputy Leader of the Federal Labor Party, Richard Marles, on a part of the world where I think his passion matches and may even outstrip even my own, the Pacific Islands. First, a bit about Richard. A solicitor turned union leader, Richard entered federal parliament as a representative of Corio in Victoria in 2007. In government, Richard served as Parliamentary Secretary for Pacific Island Affairs, Parliamentary Secretary for Foreign Affairs, and Minister for Trade. Richard has been Shadow Minister for Defence since 2016 and was appointed Deputy Leader of the Opposition in 2019. Richard is no stranger to the Institute, having delivered two lectures at our Sydney home. His last speech in 2017 was on a familiar topic, Australia and the Pacific. Somehow in his spare time, Richard has found time to pen a new book, Tides That Bind, Australia in the Pacific, the reason for him joining us on the podcast today. Richard Marles, welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations.
Great to be talking with you, Jonathan, about our shared passion.
Let's dive straight in then. As I read your new book, your passion for the Pacific really did leap off the page. Where does this passion come from? And how have you been able to sustain this passion through what must be a very busy parliamentary life?
Well, it's a good question. I refer to this trip in the book, but I think it really starts with a school trip that I was very lucky to go on back in 1984, which feels like a very long time ago now, when I was 16, and it was to Papua New Guinea. And we went for about 3 weeks. And of that, probably, I think there was only two or three nights in Port Moresby. So most of it was outside Moresby and in the highlands and hiking and going to incredibly remote places for anyone really, but certainly for in terms of what my experience had been up until that moment in time. And the colour, the vibrancy, the totally different way in which people were living their life. It enthralled me, to be honest. And I felt then that I must be witnessing the single most exotic place in the world. And remarkably, to this day, I think that's true. You know, having now seen a fair part of the world, I think literally the most exotic place on the planet is Papua New Guinea. And for me, it really was love at first sight. And it's been that way ever since. And in different guises, as a lawyer, as working at the ACTU, as a tourist and then in government, I've been to the Pacific and worked with people in the Pacific and have really come to love it. But importantly, I think seen how critical we are to the Pacific, but actually how critical the Pacific is to us in terms of the way in which we see the world and the way in which we act in the world. And, you know, one of the reviewers of the book has said that really this is a book about Australia more than the Pacific. I think that's true. I think what I'm trying to talk about as much as anything is how the Pacific should shape the way in which we see the world and how we act within the world.
You're right. I do desperately miss being able to visit PNG and I hope to be able to again soon. And as you say, Port Moresby is just the gateway, right, to PNG. You've got to get out of Port Moresby. And then once you do, you see just how vibrant and diverse that country really is.
Totally. I mean, life is just lived there in a way that it's not lived anywhere else on the planet, in the way families organise themselves, in the way societies organise themselves. And of course, you know, it's the land of the unexpected is the phrase used of PNG, but it's a land of a phenomenally huge number of different languages, which in turn reflects a huge number of different societies and cultures within PNG. So it is a kind of eternally interesting. And it speaks to the fact that I think Australians love travel. I think, you know, Australians, it's almost a rite of passage to do that backpacking year in Europe when you leave school. We like to go and see the world. It's a mystery to me, though, that one of the most remarkable places on the planet is literally right next door and very few of us go and see it. And it sort of in some ways speaks to the way we don't place the Pacific in the position that we should. And I'm not sure that what I've just said then is probably not always been the case in relation to PNG. I think an older generation where there were more people who are in PNG probably understood it, albeit in a very different context. But yeah, certainly I think we should be valuing PNG more and we should be celebrating it more and we should probably be going more.
Well, I mean, this leads on to the next question I wanted to ask. I mean, we can't expect everyone in Australia to hold the same passion we have for the region, but we can do a much better job in helping Australians to understand why the Pacific is important for Australia. I mean, you know, you can look at a map, you can see the geography, but beyond that, why is the Pacific so important for Australia? And, you know, in turn, why is Australia important for the Pacific?
Let's start with why is Australia important to the Pacific? At one level, that's the obvious question to answer. I mean, the Pacific, if you include PNG, has a population of about 10 million people, the vast vast bulk of which are in PNG. Beyond that, you've got a series of countries, some of which are tiny, like Nauru or Tuvalu, which probably have about 10,000 people each. And by contrast, having a country of 25 million people, G20, you know, one of the top 13, 14 economies in the world, you know, strong governance, all of those huge assets that are there that are highly relevant for the people of the Pacific and I think can play a really important part in the Pacific's development. And so the role that Australia could play and to a large degree does play, but in no sense am I making the point that we're not there at all. We're actually quite present in the Pacific, but I think we can do more. But the role is very significant relative to other countries, and that's how the Pacific, I think, sees us in its simplest terms. It's obviously more nuanced and complex than that. The harder question, and in a sense the one I've tried to answer in the book, is why is the Pacific important to Australia? I think the Pacific is important to Australia because the intent that we show in the world, why we want to organise ourselves as a country and what we seek to be in the world, you know, they are really the fundamental questions of foreign policy. And the place in the world where we have most influence, where we can do most to bring about change, where we can do most to help and support, is the Pacific. And so who we are and what we're on about, to me, really, in terms of foreign policy, is a question which begins in the Pacific. If we're not thinking about it in that context, then we're unlikely to think about it in its full conception, because there is no other part of the world where we will be able to give expression to what we want to be and how we want to act than the Pacific. You know, I talk about the fact that we need to demonstrate leadership, and I want to be careful about this because there's, you know, there are obvious overtones in the word. It's an intentionally used word, and it really is a word for an Australian audience in many respects. But it's not about going in and telling the Pacific what to do. That would be a terrible failing of foreign policy. I like to think of it as a listening leadership. It's actually about understanding what the Pacific wants, and trying to provide leadership amongst the other countries in the world in supporting the Pacific in what they seek to do. So it's a supportive listening leadership. But our leadership, to the extent that we give a sense to the world about what should be done, what can be done, is at its peak in the Pacific relative to anywhere else. I think you see that in the relationship that we have with the United States, for example. You know, I've had a lot to do with the US in my time, a lot of interactions with them. And by and large, given the size of the US and the size of us, as critically important a relationship it is, it's by and large one where the United States sets the tone and we are moving in that direction. That's understandable. But it is actually a reciprocal relationship. The United States, in my experience, doesn't think it knows it all. And there are some parts of the world where they look to us to understand how things operate and what's an appropriate thing to do and what's an appropriate way to act. And they look to us to provide leadership to them about what they should be doing. And the one place where that happens unambiguously is the Pacific. And so in that sense, it's the one area of the world, or the one issue, if you like, where we get to demonstrate to the United States what we look like as a leader. Well, at that moment, the Pacific is important in its own terms, but it becomes critically important in terms of the most significant relationship that we have with any country in the world. And really that then kind of paints a picture which I fundamentally believe that in so many ways the Pacific ultimately goes a long way to defining us. I think the rest of the world judges us, for good or ill, appropriately by how we act in the Pacific, by what support we provide, by ultimately what the development outcomes are like there. And there's a long way to go with those development outcomes. And so whether we like it or not, our actions there and our ability to help and assist and affect change there has a lot to do with how we are seen by the rest of the world. Well, at that point, you suddenly realise actually the Pacific is profoundly important to Australia and profoundly important to Australia's place in the world and to the way we see the world. And it's really the understanding of that which in my experience has been missing in terms of the way that those who think about foreign policy think about the Pacific, that they kind of miss the significance of what it means in terms of the broader way in which we see the world. And really, if there's a message in my book, it's that we actually need to elevate the Pacific to that level and start seeing it front and center as right there amongst the very key relationships that we have in the world. It's as significant as our relationship with the US. It's as significant as our relationship with China. It matters deeply, and we cannot afford for it to be seen as a sort of area that's niche. It needs to be front and center.
Richard, you're absolutely preaching to the choir with me, but I do worry that you and I still sit in the minority of the Australian foreign policy community with how the centrality that we put the Pacific in Australian foreign policy. Yeah, I do worry that we are actually losing, as generations go on, we're losing that Pacific nous, that Pacific expertise. I mean, I certainly see it in my generation. There's far less Pacific knowledge than there was in the generation before. I mean, you go further in your book arguing that the truth is that serious mainstream policy intent concerning the Pacific within any part of the Australian government has been missing in action for a long time. Why do you think that is? Like, why is it that thinking and talking about the Pacific in Australia doesn't reflect its importance for Australia? And not to mention the investment we put in and, as you say, the agency we have in the Pacific.
That is the great question. That is the great question. And I don't want to come to this feeling like I have all the answers. I'll have a stab at it. But you know, I guess trying to answer that question for myself is a work in progress. But what I do know is it is the great question. And I also know that to sort of reflect on you and I, Jonathan, I think the most important thing in getting people over the line is actually falling in love with the Pacific. You can, when you're speaking to people almost instantaneously within the Australian foreign policy elite, if I can call it that, I kind of know whether I'm being heard or not, because you can instantaneously tell whether the person you're talking to has fallen in love with the Pacific or not. And if they haven't, then there's not a lot of point in going further. Like you've kind of got to, it's a critical first step. And whilst it obviously did happen, in a colonial context, which we obviously need to move beyond, and we need to support Papua New Guinea as a sovereign state. In those times past, there just were a lot more Australians who were in PNG, and so there was a lot more knowledge in prior generations about PNG. That knowledge has gone. Clearly PNG needs to be independent, so it's not seeking to hark back to that moment, but it is just trying to observe that there are a lot less people who have contact. I think my best attempt at answering this question is I actually think it is about ourselves. I think it is about answering the question of what is it that we seek to do in the world. You know, why did we want to become a country? You know, what is it that we, why do we want to organise ourselves in this way? And in some ways, I think that is a question which has unfinished business from you know, the very beginnings of Australia. If there were clear answers to that about what we seek to be in the world and how we seek to play a role in the world, then I actually think playing a role in the Pacific starts to become pretty obvious. I mean, obviously we need to play a role and do everything we can with those countries which identify us as being their most important bilateral relationship. There's more than 10 countries that would say that their most important relationship is with Australia. But I reckon you could walk through the halls of DFAT, certainly the halls of Parliament, and ask people to name who those 10 countries are, and they'd be struggling to identify them. They're all in the Pacific. But if you approach this from the point of view, what is it that we seek to do in the world and how do we seek to play a part? Inevitably, you start saying, "Well, where can we play a part? Where do we have power? Power to help? Where do we have agency?" And at that point, the Pacific starts to take its form. But I think it is actually the more fundamental thing is what are we trying to do? So I would make the observation that I think over the journey, and I make this point in the book, whilst we are excellent diplomats. We might be the best diplomats in the world. People really like Australia. We bring capacity to most equations. We a pretty low maintenance. We don't have a lot of things that we're trying to push. We're good to work with. People like us. On the other hand, what is our intent? You know, what are we seeking to do? How are we seeking to have an influence on the world in a way which improves our national interests? I actually think all of those questions aren't significantly asked and answered in foreign policy terms, and that's why I think the significance of the Pacific is missed.
So look, we have made some substantive ground in the last few years in this conversation in Australian foreign policy. You know, aid to the Pacific is now at historic levels and makes up 1/3 of the overall aid program, albeit a pretty meagre overall Australian aid program. We've now got an infrastructure lending arm. We've opened new diplomatic missions around the region. The profile of the Pacific has been raised in most parts of the federal bureaucracy to, you know, a deputy secretary in DFAT, for example, under the auspices of the Office of the Pacific. So from where I sit, I feel like the Morrison government step up is by no means tokenistic. But you think we need to go further?
I do, but I'd acknowledge what you said as well. I don't want to be mean about that. I think the step up has been a really important move in the right direction, and I accept everything that you've said. I still think we've got a long way to go. I think if we both of us wandered into DFAT and started saying, you know, deep down, what matters, who matters, and what matters, I'm not sure the Pacific is right up there in the top shelf in the way in which we've just described it. It perhaps should be. So that if you like, describes the gap in terms of where it needs to be versus where it is now. But I accept that there has been a move in the right direction. But I guess there are a couple of other points to make. I mean, development assistance is really important. It's a symbol of our commitment to the world, but to any particular place in which we provide development assistance. Yes, the proportion of development assistance in the Pacific is there, but you know, relative to where it's been, I don't think we've seen the trajectory of development assistance in the way that we would have liked. And then the other obvious point is climate change. Climate change is an existential issue in the Pacific in a way that is hard to understand for Australians. So, it's obviously different in different parts of the Pacific, but certain parts of the Pacific are literally on the front line. I mean, a place like Kiribati, Tarawa, which is a low-lying coral atoll, heavily populated, a slight change in weather patterns there puts a massive stress on the water security, and that's climate change is a huge function of that. You could say the same in respect of Tuvalu. You can say the same in respect of the Marshall Islands. Throughout the Pacific, it is a much more present and bigger issue. And I think almost the ticket to play in the Pacific is about having a policy in respect of climate change, which means that we as a nation are playing our part in dealing with the question of our own emissions.
Your language here in the book is really quite impactful. You say, unlocking all forms of engagement in the Pacific requires one critical key. Australia must have a credible position around action on climate change. Now, despite the spin, we are certainly at the wrong end of the pack when it comes to climate ambition, with Pacific nations firmly at the other end of that spectrum and in many ways leading the charge on climate change advocacy globally. So it's going to take a big leap for us to get into the middle of the pack from where we are now. And there's no guarantee that being in the middle of the pack will even please Pacific leaders. I mean, do you think Labor's really up to that challenge? And if we don't get energy policy right, is upping our engagement with the Pacific just a futile effort?
Well, I think getting policy in respect of climate change is pretty important in terms of meaningfully engaging with the Pacific. I definitely have that view, which is I've expressed in the book. And yes, we are very much up to that challenge, as I think we were when we were last in government. And you're right in absolute terms. I mean, if you're looking at this as emissions per capita, we've got a long way to go. I would say that it was pretty clear when we were last in government that we were making an effort. A serious effort in terms of Australia coming to terms with climate change in itself, but also playing a role on the global stage. And I think the role in relation to the Pacific is to help support its voice. It's not to be in there telling the Pacific story for it. No one can do that in a way which is more compelling than the Pacific itself. But I think there are lots of ways in which we can support the Pacific in them telling their story. But it's obviously got to make sense in the context of the efforts that we are seeking to make in relation to climate change. Now, we all come from the, you know, every country comes from the position, the starting point that it does. I mean, it's part of Labor's DNA to have meaningful action on climate change. It always has. I mean, really going back to the Hawke government, literally to Bob Hawke, we've been, we have seen meaningful action on climate change as completely central to who we are. And I think that you would see that exhibited under an Albanese Labor government. And I think the sincerity and intent of that would be received in the Pacific. And I think it would enable us to further our engagement and diplomacy within the Pacific. But I also think it would allow us to help support the Pacific in them telling their story as well. And that's what we should be trying to do.
Just changing tacks a little bit here. In the book, you also argue for a much more ambitious agenda for access by Pacific nations to the Australian economy. You know, both sides of politics here deserve credit for establishing and expanding the fantastic temporary migration opportunities like the seasonal workers program, but it still remains incredibly difficult for Pacific Islanders to permanently migrate to Australia. Under 1% of Australia's population identifies having non-Maori Pacific ancestry, and almost two-thirds of those have come through the back door, you know, through via New Zealand and its more liberal migration policies with certain Pacific nations. Is there a future role for some sort of Pacific Access Category visa to enable more permanent migration between Pacific nations and Australia to give more of that Pacific vibrancy to the Australian multicultural experience?
Well, the Pacific definitely adds vibrancy wherever it goes. I think really what I'm trying to say here is that development assistance is really important, and I don't seek to divert attention from that, but I really do want to make the point that we can do so much more, and that seeing our engagement with the Pacific through a narrow lens of how much development assistance we're doing is in fact a very narrow lens. The real opportunity, it seems to me, for us to help the Pacific, to help change outcomes, to help the Pacific in its development, is to provide, well, is to really leverage off the fact of having the economy that we have right here in the Pacific, and also to leverage off the considerable resources that we have as in government and in the government activity that we undertake to help in various functions in the Pacific as well. So when you're talking about the economy, one of the things that the Seasonal Workers Program does is start walking us down that path. And it's been a benefit to Australia. It's been a benefit to Australian farmers. It's not really had any impact on, like any negative impact on Australian jobs. It's really been in a space where backpackers might otherwise be operating. But what it has meant for those coming from the Pacific to work in agricultural settings in Australia, to come back year after year or season after season, is just massively important. And I do think that we need to be looking more imaginatively at all of that. Now, that, you know, there are visa implications associated with all of that. So I think we do need to be thinking more imaginatively about it. Knowing that we're talking about really small populations, this is not going to have much sort of impact on the makeup of Australia, but what it can do is have a huge impact in terms of the Pacific and its development, and that's what the goal has got to be. And along the way, I think we can benefit as well. And once we really apply our minds to that and fully unlock the potential of what it would mean to, you know, really leverage the economy in relation to the Pacific's development and really leverage the government services and the functioning of government to the Pacific's development, that's when I think we really do actually change things or help change things for the better. And done the right way, you know, where the Pacific is in control here, where we're there to support, we're not there to demand, where we just want to help, done with the right humility, if I can put it that way, I think we can really change things. But the other point I make is we need to, because you know, the Pacific development is a huge challenge in the Pacific, and it ought to be our call to action. And I refer to the Millennium Development Goals, which finished a while ago. I get that, but they were still a pretty significant marker on how the Pacific was performing relative to the rest of the world. And you know, we need to be helping the Pacific a lot. That's got to be a call to action.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more on that one, Richard. And we could spiral down that rabbit hole talking about shared service delivery, because I agree with you. That is such fertile ground for more that Australia could be doing in the region. But it is a foreign policy conversation in 2021, so I can't let you get away without talking about China. In your book, you rightly say that basing our action in the Pacific on an attempt to strategically deny China would be a historic mistake. But is strategic denial really the ambition of Australia's new renewed engagement in the region? I mean, there's no doubt we are in a strategic competition with China, but as long as we compete in ways that are of benefit to the Pacific by providing better alternatives, doesn't this just help bolster the case for greater action in the region and not undermine it?
Look, I think the way you phrased it there is pretty good. And I think if what we do and if we kind of keep our guiding light being to help the Pacific and its development, to really put at the focus of our action the welfare of the 10 million people of the Pacific, then I think, you know, the rest is going to fall into place. Look, I'm not naive in the sense that I totally understand we live in a contested world, and I think there is strategic competition in the Pacific. I think that is happening, and Australia clearly has interests in all of that. Of course, we do. The point I'm really making, though, is that if we use as our guiding light, and I think sometimes this becomes the discourse, the denial of a third country. Like, that's what we are seeking. That's really why we're engaging here. We want to engage in strategic denial. Well, I'm not sure we will succeed in the strategic denial, and I certainly don't think we will succeed in terms of building the relationships with the countries of the Pacific. And so, I don't think it gets us anywhere. I think the way we need to be acting, both in terms of, you know, our place in the world and what I was talking about earlier, what I think should be our intent and our mission, which is to help the people of the Pacific, to support them, to improve their development. I think if that is the focus, I think it will also be the best way we can serve our strategic interests along the way. And that's really the argument that I'm trying to make.
Also, to keep it topical, let's talk about the unprecedented COVID crisis is still engrossing the region. Instead of focusing on the crisis itself, I thought it might be good to talk about how we can get out of it. You know, in the shadow of the Delta variant, zero COVID no longer seems a realistic goal for some island countries, and particularly those dependent on tourism like Fiji. Other countries like Papua New Guinea are having trouble convincing anyone to get vaccinated. Does Australia need to prepare to show how to live with COVID to give the region the impetus to get vaccinated and reopen? Or do we need to press on with a zero tolerance approach? There's a really thorny one, I know.
Yeah, look, it's obviously, that's a really difficult question. I think when you look at Australia, when you look at, you know, countries in Western Europe, the UK, when you look at America, and then in a sense, when you look at Taiwan or China or Indonesia, I mean, what you see across the board are really different journeys that are being travelled by each of those countries in relation to COVID-19. So I'm not sure that there's a sort of a case to be made about leading by example here. I think we've got to work out COVID-19 on our own terms and how we get to the other side of it. And that's going to look different to probably a set of varying journeys of the various countries in the Pacific Island Forum. What I think matters then in terms of our role in the Pacific is to be supporting each of them on the journeys that they're on. Clearly, vaccination is a key part of it. Ultimately, you know, what actually underpins a whole lot of this is health systems and the way in which we provide support to health systems. This COVID-19 is going to take its place amidst a whole lot of other conditions that exist in the Pacific, which negatively impact health outcomes in the Pacific. And we've just got to be making sure that we're doing everything we can to support the Pacific in tackling this, as we do tackling a range of other conditions, so that we help the health outcomes of the Pacific. To me, it is part of the development challenge of the Pacific. As I say, vaccination is a critical part of that. Making sure there are enough ventilators, making sure that there are good hospitals which can treat the symptoms of COVID, all of that's going to be really important as well, and we need to play our part there. I think in terms of that question of leading by example, I think we we've got a pretty difficult road to travel, one which I think has been made more difficult by the way in which the Morrison government has handled this, particularly in terms of vaccine rollout and quarantine facilities in Australia. But that said, you know, we've got to be doing everything we can here to make our own pathway to the other side of COVID-19. And for us, clearly, vaccination is central to how we do that.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more on that one, Richard. And it's encouraging to see the good work that the Australian government is doing in provision of supply of vaccines to the Pacific. I mean, there's so much more we could talk about here. Shared service delivery, blended sovereignty, the aid program, any one of your trips to the region. But with the tragic imagery coming out of Afghanistan, I thought it would be appropriate to talk about state intervention, and namely the Australian-led regional assistance mission to Solomon Islands, otherwise known as RAMSI. In your book, you note that RAMSI was a triumph in regional cooperation. It was a model for how an international intervention supported by a local community can restore peace in a nation. Former US Defense Secretary Jim Mattis agrees. In a conversation in October last year with our director, Michael Fullilove, he noted RAMSI was a best in practice intervention abroad. So what do you think was needed for RAMSI to be a success when so many other state interventions, including as we're now seeing in real time in Afghanistan, have failed?
Yeah, well, again, good question. Firstly, we were acting in concert with the Solomon Islands government. Now, you look at our actions in, well, Afghanistan and in places like Iraq, and, you know, a lot of those actions have occurred with the requests of those governments as well. But I think being, you know, working hand in glove with the host government to meet its support, or to meet its aims is critical. I think really what set RAMSI apart was that it was, as the title suggests, a regional assistance mission. It wasn't just Australian faces, although there were lots of them who were part of the mission, but it involved contingents from just about every country in the Pacific Island Forum. This was the Pacific family coming to help one of its members. And so I think that was a critical part of the character of RAMSI, which helped its success. It was well done in the sense that the logistics were good, the resources were there. It did bring about a sense of law and order, so that, you know, it got past the immediate threat of the violence. It stayed the course in terms of helping with ranges of capacity building exercises and development. So, I mean, all of those things were done well. But I think if I was to point to anything, it is that sense that this was not just Australia coming in and trying to sort things out in circumstances where there was disorder and Solomon Islands put its hand up and asked for help. It was, in fact, that's really not the character of it at all. It was the whole of the Pacific, and therefore the whole of the Pacific had a sense of ownership in the mission, and it really, you know, there was a sense of family, I think, about it, and I think the Pacific took a lot of pride. I mean, beyond Solomon's, when you went around the Pacific and you met people who had served there, there was an enormous sense of pride in what they had done for a member of the family, and I think that's what sets it apart. And actually, I do think that model is on display in other parts of the world. I mean, there have been better outcomes, albeit off a low base, in Africa, for example. And a lot of the missions that are put together by the UN or the African Union in Africa involve African nations doing that work. And so that sense of kind of regional engagement of helping another member of the family, I think, is really profoundly important in terms of defining the character of the intervention. In the eyes of those of the public, and in the eyes of those who are being assisted.
Just to echo your that sentiment, I was fortunate to be in Honiara for the concluding ceremonies of Ramsay as we officially wound down the Ramsay Initiative, and it was just phenomenal. It was an informal Pacific Island Forum's leaders meeting because leaders just wanted to be there, and then on the ground you're just meeting police officers from Vanuatu, Niue, from all over the place who paid for themselves to get there just because they wanted to be part of it, because to them this was the most formative, important part of their careers, is to be part of this regional initiative. And I completely agree with you. It was so impactful.
And you think about that from Niue. You know, Niue is a place of 2,000 people, and they made their contribution, and it mattered. You know, and be easy to argue, it's only a couple of people, but gee, it's so important for Niue, and that Niue was engaged in this becomes really important in terms of the character of the whole exercise.
Look, Richard, finally, I did want to ask you a more career-oriented question. What would be your advice to a junior careerist wanting to start out in this space? I mean, what should they do? What would be the best way for them to contribute to the Australia-Pacific relationship?
Well, I think if I was addressing that to, say, a young graduate into DFAT, and I've done exactly those gatherings before, or spoken to those gatherings before, it would be think about the Pacific first. You know, think about where you'll have an impact. I still worry that you know, young person in DFAT looking for their first appointment overseas, you know, might romantically have eyes on kind of Rome or Berlin or Paris. Yeah, it'd be fun. It'd be fun to go to all those places. But you won't be anywhere near as big a deal, anywhere near as impactful. You won't be able to achieve anywhere near as much as if you go to Tarawa. And it's a harder posting, and you know, they're aren't the same museums to go to, but you will change lives for the better. I mean, I think people who go into public service do so with a sense of mission, about wanting to make the world a better place, about wanting to make a difference, a change for good. Well, if that's what drives you, then the Pacific is the place to aspire to and the place to go, and kind of allow yourself to fall in love with it. It is a remarkable place. You know, global heritage would be very different and much the lesser for the Pacific not being there. It's a deeply, deeply precious part of the world where there are unique ways in which people live, where there are unique ways in which people make music and engage in art and earn a living. And it's just a fabulous, fabulous part of the world, and it's one where we can have a huge impact, but it's also a part of the world where, you know, there is a lot of support that needs to be provided. You know, I make this point in the book. You go to Bacio, which is an islet in Tarawa. You know, living conditions there are as bad, difficult as I've seen anywhere in the world. And I've been to refugee camps in Africa. I've been to slums in India. The currency in Kiribati is the Australian dollar. The biggest aid provider in Kiribati is Australia. If we're not helping there, when kind of no one is. So, you know, that is a place where you can help and where help is needed, and you can really make a difference, and we should. You know, you kind of leave with a sense of accomplishment and satisfaction and purpose, which I can't imagine can be found in Rome or Paris or Berlin, as important as those postings are. So I think that's what I would be saying to any young member of the diplomatic corps beginning their career, and in a way you could reflect that upon anyone who's interested in foreign policy. The Pacific is a great place to start. You'll do more and you'll learn more about our country there than anywhere else in the world.
Richard, thank you so much for your time today. Let's hope some of this passion has rubbed off on our audience. Richard's new book, Tides That Bind, is available now through Monash University Publishing. Richard, thank you again.
Thanks, Jonathan.
You've been listening to Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute. Production assistance today has been provided by Josh Godding, and thanks to Sav Chirombolo from Richard's office in helping put this together. See you next time.